one aspect that I think is really important to note is that the movement that we saw in the field of medicine in general, really reconsidering and questioning our practices related to how we think about race and medical algorithms, began years before. And one point to highlight is it was really sparked in part by the reflections of medical students and early career trainees. There's an article published in the New England Journal called Hidden in Plain Sight. And that's a reflection, actually, of medical students as they went through their rotations, noticing that race was in several different algorithms in OBGYN, in nephrology, or how we assess kidney disease, in cardiology, and in one of the areas included in how we interpret lung function. And so those types of really heightened awareness led the American Thoracic Society and other professional organizations to realize that we needed to convene and really think about the historic precedent and why we came to be considering race and lung function. Was it necessary? And review the scientific evidence in a rigorous way. And those publications are the aggregate and the communication reflecting several years, really, of dialogue and of review of the scientific evidence. And as you've mentioned, the conclusion of these bodies of work was that the recommendation was to no longer include race in how we interpret lung function.
Is there some evidence for longer, more chronic effects of wildfire exposure?
Unfortunately, there are, and we have to be very mindful of them. And it's one of the reasons why we have to be so careful, not only during the fire, but also afterwards in our exposure to those areas. The lungs are the most obvious area where we can see long-term effects. It can cause prolonged issues with asthma, prolonged damage to the lungs that can cause long-term problems with lung capacity, or it can exacerbate other lung disease as well. It can also affect the heart and the other organs in the body long-term. There are studies that have shown an increase in the amount of heart disease and the number of deaths from heart disease and lung disease long-term after exposure to these wildfires and the chemicals and particles associated with it. Increased risk of problems with pregnancies moving forward, and unfortunately also an increase in the prevalence and incidence of cancer after exposure to the wildfires and those chemicals as well. So it is a long-term issue, and people have to take that very seriously when they go back to areas where these fires have occurred.
Previously, the age started at age 55 with a 30-pack year history of smoking. And the reason why the USPSTF and CMS changed their criteria, decreasing the age to 50 and decreasing pack years to 20, is that it was under-selecting large populations that are at high risk for individuals. They were under-selecting high-risk individuals, mainly being women and those of different races, such as African Americans, who tend to smoke fewer pack years. So with that, I think it's really important for us to understand the criteria that it was and where we are right now. And what's important about the USPSTF criteria is that it is covered by insurance without any cost sharing under the Affordable Care Act and under Medicare. So it eliminates the financial barrier to screening. And that's a really important point.
Both short-term standards, in other words, looking at acute effects of air pollution exposure over short periods of time, and the cumulative effects of exposure day after day after day, and the long-term standards. For example, with the short-term standards, children with asthma will get reactions to the pollution it causes. Especially, for example, fine particles and ozone will cause inflammation in their lungs. And that can lead to an exacerbation of their asthma, causing them to have to use their rescue meds. But then in the longer term, it can actually give disease to form. In other words, for example, asthma, the recent studies looking at the Children's Health Study in California found that children who live near trafficked areas with higher nitrogen oxides and ozone levels and fine particles had a higher rate of getting asthma. So there's both the long-term cumulative effects of creating new disease and then the acute effects of worsening and exacerbating the disease in the short term.
The major goal of GOLD is basically distill whatever information we have from clinical trials and the best epidemiologic, pathophysiologic evidence that we have and make it clinically relevant for someone who's seeing patients that they can adopt those recommendations. And when the ABCD classification first came out, it was always based on patient symptoms, with the severity of symptoms being an important factor, the threshold, and also the presence of exacerbations, whether more frequent, moderate, or severe. And the way the four quadrants work with ABCD was the more symptoms you had would drive you to the right, so C and D, and the more exacerbations that you had would drive you towards north, more towards C and D. And in reality, there's very few patients that have less symptoms that have frequent or severe exacerbations. So that C group became very small and always was. So in light of that, trying to make things focused on what's most important for the patient, we thought it was most important to grade the symptoms. And if you had moderate or severe exacerbations, regardless of your symptomatology, that would be captured by just labeling that group one group, which was E. So it was a point of the practicality of not many patients are asymptomatic or very low symptom burden with frequent, moderate, or severe exacerbations, and trying to make something that was more clinically relevant to the practitioner.
Just what you said, Dr. Rizzo, is so important. We used to think everything was sterile. I'm sorry to tell you, though, the gut is not sterile, the lungs are not sterile, and perhaps most worrisome of all, the brain is not sterile. We started seeing over the past 15, 20 years that our problem was just lack of the ability to detect small organisms. Now, with PCR and other mechanisms, we can see viruses in the brain. Herpes viruses are very common in the trigeminal cells, then from there they migrate into the brain. So that's what we have to live with. But if our diet is a healthful diet, we are selected for good immunity and for hopefully casting out the more pathogenic microorganisms.
When there are events like in Lahaina or in with Tropical Storm Helene in North Carolina, healthcare professionals are often dealing with their own disasters. And so how do you mobilize people who are already dealing with their own personal disasters to care for the injured and the sick? And so all of this has to be thought of and really approached in a very deep way before a disaster happens. And that means not just keeping those conversations within the four walls of your institution, but branching out and talking to community organizations, talking to local and state government and even regional consortia, because it's, you know, it really is something that, as you can imagine, there's so many levels of complexity. So yes, that resilience does have to do with the buildings and with talking with engineers and architects in advance, but there's so much more to it than that. And it really is worthwhile putting in the effort up front. You know, there have been some estimates because it, you know, I know that all health systems, not just now, but you know, for years, many are operating on shoestring budgets. But there really is an economic argument to a lot of this. There are some estimates that hospital damages from extreme weather can range from about $600,000 up to $2 billion. And the World Health Organization actually estimates that for retrofitting, you could invest as little as 1% of the value of the hospital and possibly protecting up to 90% of a hospital's assets. So it really is important from an investment perspective to think about resilience in that lens as well.